Hi, Just a Bite listeners. This is Jory from the Ohio Association of Food Banks. I'm so pleased to get to intro this episode in which my colleague Sarah talks with Dr. Lauren Jones, assistant professor in the Department of Human Sciences and Consumer Sciences at The Ohio State University. Her research background and specialty is in the impact of government policies that affect children, low-income families, and other vulnerable populations. So she has an incredible grasp of the broad literature as it relates to policies like the Advanced Expanded Child Tax Credit, which we still hope to see solidified in federal policy. So I just find this research-informed conversation really informative and engaging, which I think is a rare combination. And I hope you do too. Enjoy.
Hi, Professor Lauren Jones. Thank you so much for being on Just a Bite today. To start out, could you introduce yourself and give the listeners some background on your research and your work?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Lauren Jones. I'm an associate professor at The Ohio State University, and I teach in the departments of Human Sciences and the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. And I'm also a faculty associate at the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy. And so my research is focused on policies that impact low-income families. And I'm interested in how, the way we shape and implement policies like, for example, the child tax credit, and then similarly, the earned income tax credit here in the United States, how those policies and decisions we make about them impact the way families are able to use the money, how families respond in terms of their work and childcare arrangements, and other behavioral outcomes. And then, you know, just kind of overall how those policies benefit families.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, to give the listeners some context around our discussion today, the American Rescue Plan Act expanded the child tax credit to go to more families, to increase the amount of the credit families receive, and to split up the credit into monthly payments for 2021. As many of our listeners, I'm sure, remember, the Build Back Better Act, which included spending for child nutrition programs, affordable housing, drug price negotiation program, as well as provisions to improve tax enforcement so that billionaires pay what they owe, among other things, also tried to make some of the enhanced child tax credit provisions permanent. Negotiations on Build Back Better have been ongoing since summer of 2021, yet they have stalled since December. So you sort of joined the noise as far as the child tax credit goes. And in September, you were one of the 400 plus economists that signed on to a letter urging Congress to make the enhanced child tax credit permanent. And your research was even cited in that letter, which is very impressive, by the way. Could you explain what you and your colleagues were arguing in that letter?
Yeah, well, I'll first start by saying that was like a real high point in my career, having my research cited in support of what I think is such an important and, could be a really positive change for American families across the country. So to answer your question, what my colleagues and I were really trying to argue is that the, you know, proposed expansions to the child tax credit, based on, years of work that many of us have done, and reading of the literature by those 400 economists, really, see the child tax credit and the expansion of the child tax credit as a policy change that, doesn't have a lot of downsides. So, work, including my work, has shown that when you expand tax credits targeted to families with kids, families are able to use the money to buy things that we think are really important inputs to raising kids. For example, healthy food, which is an important one to you all, I know. Other things include childcare, educational inputs like books and things like that. So, what we see is that transferring, you know, doing a cash transfer to families in the form of a tax credit really results in families being able to meet the needs that they have in order to, you know, raise healthy children that will grow up to be themselves productive members of the economy. And, you know, ultimately, you know, have higher earnings themselves, which will in turn pay for some of the initial investments. So, you know, from that perspective, the signatories of that letter really agreed that the expansion of the child tax credit had really a lot of positives and not many negatives that we could see based on the research.
Yeah, the research is, I mean, pretty consistent across the board, it seems like, but there are still some common misconceptions about the impact of the child tax credit, many of which are cited by some congressional members, and then some of which you and your colleagues have addressed in that letter. So I wanted to ask you, does this child tax credit inhibit work? And then also, does the child tax credit contribute to the inflation we're seeing in the economy right now?
Sure. So in terms of the, you know, on the work front, based on the research, we're finding that, you know, our predictions are that there would be very little labor supply response to the, if we were to make the expansion to the child tax credit permanent. So, you know, that finding is based on what we call kind of policy experiments in other countries that have implemented or expanded similar programs. So, for example, Canada expanded their child tax credit in 2016 into a program that looks very similar to what the expanded child tax credit here in the United States looks like. And research on that program has found no evidence that there was any labor supply changes in response to the expansion. Here in the United States, there's been some kind of modeling to see what we, you know, what we predict would happen if the child tax credit were expansion were to be made permanent, because of course we've never done something like this here in the United States before, so it's difficult for us to kind of we don't have experience, right? So we're kind of going based on our best informed predictions and modeling that we can do. And those studies have also shown, for the most part, pretty limited responses in terms of labor supply to the child tax credit. And so a big reason for that is that, you know, the structure of the expanded child tax credit, if you kind of look at it, if you were to kind of graph it, you'd kind of see, you know, for a really large income range for households earning up to almost $200,000 a year, there's no kind of change in the child tax credit over that earnings range, right? You get the same amount. And the phase out period kind of only starts for households earning more than $200,000, meaning that, you know, those sort of really higher income households are the households that are seeing declining child tax credit in response to higher earnings. And so one really nice feature of structuring the program like that is that for families who are at the lower end of the income distribution, who we think are going to be kind of more responsive to that kind of benefit cliff situation, right, where earning more is going to cause you to lose some of your benefits, we've structured the expanded child tax credit in such a way that that's not going to happen, because they don't have reduced earning or reduced credit in response to higher earnings. So, you know, in some ways that makes the expanded child tax credit look a lot more similar to a universal basic income type credit, where everyone's receiving the same amount of money. It's not a universal credit because, as I was saying, for those really high earning families, those families are seeing reductions in the credit as their earnings increase. But the reality is, for households earning that much, the credit, you know, the amount of the credit in real terms and kind of relative terms doesn't have as much value to them. And so they're much less likely to respond to it in terms of their labor supply decisions. So I think, you know, based on what we've seen in other countries like Canada, for example, who, as I said, implemented or where such a credit was implemented, and we didn't see a labor supply response. And based on the modeling and the kind of theory behind it that researchers have used to predict what would happen here in the U.S. if the credit were to be made permanent, you know, my colleagues and I really agree that there's not much concern that making the credit permanent would have strong labor supply changes and kind of, you know, deter people's willingness to work in any severe way. So that's the answer to your first question, that I think no, you know, straight up, I don't think you can expect to see much labor supply response to making the credit permanent. In response to the inflation question, you know, I think the question there is, why are we seeing such high inflation right now, right? So we know that the child tax credit was expanded in 2021. Families were receiving, you know, more money, and they were receiving it on a regular basis, which could also change spending patterns. The question I think you want to ask yourself, if you want to think through this on your own, is, you know, how much could that possibly affect demand for goods compared to all the other changes we saw in 2021 in our economy? So, you know, I was just kind of looking up some numbers between, you know, the middle of 2020, middle of 2021, nearly 15 million people returned to work. We were also coming off a period of extremely high personal savings rates, so a 50-year high in household savings rates during the pandemic. So, you know, those two factors combined is clearly going to lead to increased demand for goods, right? We've also kind of seen, you know, issues on the supply side, and there being kind of supply chain issues that are stifling the supply of goods, right? So we have kind of a classic situation here where we've got increased demand due to these market forces, you know, reduced supply due to other economic factors that are kind of causing ports to be clogged and that kind of thing. And the question you really want to ask yourself is, amidst all that, how much could the child tax credit really be contributing to this issue? I'm not going to say that it has no effect, but based on my reading, it's really a drop in the bucket compared to these existing economic factors that are affecting everybody in the economy, not just the families with kids who are receiving the child tax credit. So, you know, I think that, you know, just looking at the data on that front, my answer to your question would be that if it is affecting inflation at all, which it could be, it would be a really small effect relative to these other forces that are kind of at play right now.
I think that's really great framing. I don't think I've really heard it sort of framed that way. And like you mentioned earlier, a lot of families are using this credit for necessities. And so I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail about what families are generally spending this credit on each month.
Yeah, so early research on the expanded child tax credit that families were receiving in 2021 indicated that they were spending it, you know, exactly as you said, Sarah, on everyday necessities, healthy food, for example, childcare needs. That also confirms studies from other contexts, including my own work in the Canadian context, where we found that expansion of that same Child Canada benefit, which mimics the expanded child tax credit program, structured almost exactly the same as the U.S. child tax credit. We saw the exact same thing. Families use the money on healthy food, buying food at home rather than out at restaurants. We found evidence that families use the money for childcare, for tuition. And we saw some evidence of families using the money for recreation as well. So, you know, using some of the money to go out and spend some time together. In the Canadian context, we also kind of interestingly found that when the Canadian child benefit was made more generous, families appeared to reduce their consumption of alcohol and tobacco products. So I think that really points to, you know, the idea that when families have enough money, it reduces stress in the household. You know, they're able to use some of that child tax credit money to go to the movies together. That's a really wonderful thing for a family, you know? And what we see is that, you know, some of these indicators of household stress and, you know, kind of financial stress that can really impact a child's well-being and child performance in school and things like that. We find that this cash transfer can really help those issues by just easing the budget constraint and allowing families to spend money on things every family spends money on, right? Food, childcare, having fun together.
Yeah. We don't just want families to survive, but also to thrive and bond with one another. And even we just heard about this preliminary research just a couple days ago about how there's some suggestion that monthly cash payments increase brain development or frequencies in infants, as well as, you know, building research about how these monthly payments are increasingly lifting families out of poverty. And so I was wondering, what has the research shown about these benefits of monthly payments to families?
Well, the research is pretty conclusive, I would say. You know, for the most part, studies on programs like the Expanded Child Tax Credit show that, you know, these programs are good for kids. They're good for their, you know, educational outcomes. They're good for college going. So kids who lived in families that received generous earned income tax credits, for example, when they were younger, are more likely to attend college. We see improvements in kind of behavioral outcomes for kids. And, you know, I loved reading about that study that you mentioned showing that, you know, even in utero, we're seeing some evidence that, you know, cash transfer, cash infusion to a family that doesn't have enough to make ends meet can even potentially have important impacts on a fetus. That really confirms what we found in other contexts, or looking at other kind of maternal outcomes. So research on the earned income tax credit shows that moms-to-be who receive more generous credits are also more likely to use prenatal care and reduced maternal smoking. So, you know, I think there's like a clear mechanism for why transferring cash to an expectant mother could lead to increased neural activity in her fetus, you know, not only because the money's going to allow her to eat better, et cetera, all things that we know are important in terms of creating a healthy environment for a fetus to grow in, but, you know, also increasing her access to important care that she needs. So most outcomes we've looked at as a research community, we've found really, really important benefits on a whole host of outcomes for kids and moms.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the research sort of debunks the misconceptions and myths that people are using, you know, these cash payments for drugs or alcohol or not benefiting their kids in any way, when that's just clearly not the case. So, you know, January was the first month without the monthly payment for families. I know our food banks are really nervous and sort of hunkering down as we are preparing to weather the storm with families coming back into our food bank lines. We saw a reduction of families coming into our food bank lines when they were receiving that child tax credit. And so we're preparing in February, especially. But what are some of the consequences of Congress not passing the Build Back Better Act with the extension of the enhanced child tax credit?
Well, I mean, one clear one is kind of settling for higher child poverty rates, right? And so, you know, it's kind of, it's not rocket science to understand that if you give a family that does not have enough money, if you give them cash, that's going to move the family out of poverty. So, you know, when we don't pass, it's seeming more and more as though this bill is not going to pass, and at least the child tax credit expansion part of it is not going to pass. But I still have my fingers crossed. But, you know, if it does turn out that it's not passed, it's really us as a society kind of, you know, stating that we're okay with more kids being in poverty, not having enough food, not having enough childcare, and not having the resources that the family needs in order for the parents to find a job that works for their family and they can, you know, continue working. So I think that's kind of another important component of it, that we're not just seeing kids in poverty, we're seeing the family in poverty. And when the family is in poverty, the parents are put in a position where they need to accept whatever job comes along in order to, you know, keep food on the table. Whereas if there is a support program in place, they're able to wait for that job that's going to work for their family. They're able to stay in that job for the longer term, which is going to have then benefits for the company that's hired them, because we're going to have less turnover, et cetera, right? So, you know, this is these are policies that really impact the entire family. The other thing I'll say, a brand new paper coming out, or just came out in National Tax Journal, that shows essentially that with the kind of status quo child tax credit, where the tax credit was not fully refundable, that kind of feature of the tax credit meant that families of color were disproportionately left out of that support program. So the way, I'll just kind of review this really quickly for your listeners, the way refundability works in tax credits, a fully refundable tax credit is a tax credit you get whether or not you owe taxes. So even if you have zero tax liability, if you're eligible for a $1,000 tax credit and the tax credit is refundable, you get that $1,000 in your pocket. Whereas a non-refundable tax credit worth $1,000 is only going to be valuable, is only going to have value to a family that owes taxes, right? So you need to kind of earn enough money that you owe at least $1,000 in federal taxes in order to get the benefit of that non-refundable tax credit. So, you know, one of the big changes, and in my view, really the most important change of the expanded child tax credit, was that it moved it from a non-refundable credit or a partially refundable credit to a fully refundable credit, which meant that that big change really expanded access to the credit for the lowest earning families. So these are families, we're talking about families earning less than $20,000 a year. And those families are disproportionately families of color. So, you know, going back to the status quo child tax credit, I think is going to have implications for child poverty, going to have implications for you know, the kind of stability of working in those families. It also has important implications for equity concerns and the extent to which the structure of our social safety net kind of disproportionately leaves out families of color. So I think that's another important concern that for me is really, you know, one of the most important issues here, that we have a part of our tax code, a part of our social safety net that disproportionately benefits white families over families of color. And I think, you know, more and more we need to be aware of the way that our existing structure of these programs are kind of, you know, building in and reinforcing the inequities we see every day in our society.
Yeah, that was really well put. And there's so much here to sort of dig into. I just want to thank you so much for being on today. This was great. I think you really shed some light on this issue, and we are going to keep on working on it and trying to encourage our congressional members to really consider the Build Back Better Act, but especially the child tax credit and the expansion of that investment. So just to end on, how can the listeners find more of your work?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great to come on and talk about one of my favorite topics, tax credits. I love taxes. And yeah, I'd love to hear from any of your listeners. You can find me at OSU, at the Glenn College, or you can find me at on Twitter. My handle is at Prof. Lauren Jones, or on my website, which is laurenedenjones.com.
Well, I know that I'm enormously grateful to have researchers like Professor Jones in this field of study. I can't think of any field that has more direct implications for the dignity and security of families and kids. And while we may feel like transferring cash to households with fewer resources is common sense policy to reduce hunger and hardship, It matters to have the clear perspective of bias-free policy research to support the case for tax credits for workers and families. So in closing, I'll just say that we agree with economist Greg Duncan, one of 9 co-authors of the preliminary study Sarah mentioned, showing that cash payments increased brain activity in babies, who said he hopes this research would refocus the debate toward the question of, quote, whether the payments are good for kids, end quote. It's that simple, and we can still get federal policy that includes the advanced expanded child tax credit done. So let's do this. Thanks again to Professor Jones for joining us and for her work in this field of study, and we look forward to having you on our next episode. Till then, have a good one.